And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We got a special treat for you this segment, this edition. In fact, this is so special. We've been able to talk our network into dropping the bottom break. So we have a full hour, full 56 minutes with our two guests. And, I have so much respect for both of these individuals, and in particular, Mr. Clint Hill. Now, I don't know if you're old enough like me to remember the scenes from November 22nd, 1963 in Dallas, Texas, when President Kennedy was shot in Dealey Plaza. Now, last March, I had the occasion to tour Dealey Plaza for the first time, but my first memory of that, of course, I mean, my memories of that forever etched in my mind that day in 1963. I was a young, very young man, but my first memory of our guest, Clint Hill, was an appearance that he made on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace. I believe it was 60 Minutes Overtime. It was in 1975. It was right after he had to quit the Secret Service. And I remember the emotion of that brief interview that was broadcasting. I think you can find it on YouTube. And that day I was watching with my mom and dad, and I was over there one Sunday night, and I mean, that really got to me. But our guests tonight are two individuals. Clint Hill, a man, a Secret Service agent who served under five U.S. presidents, presidential administrations. He was Jackie Kennedy's personal, Secret Service agent. He joined the Secret Service when there was only 269 agents in the entire Secret Service Bureau, 48, I believe, in the Presidential Protection Detail. And, of course, he was assigned to Jackie Kennedy after Eisenhower, and then a little bit disappointed. I'm going to let Lisa and Clint talk about this, but nonetheless, he ended up serving, in addition to Eisenhower and Jackie Kennedy, and of course Dallas, he ended up serving a total of five presidents. And he with Lisa McCubbin have three books: Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, and then two other books, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, that came out in 2012, and 5 Days in November, that came out in 2014. And it's interesting, he met Lisa McCubbin, who's also joining Mr. Hill. Lisa McCubbin, she's an award-winning journalist, number one New York Times best-selling author. She collaborated with Clint Hill to write his very poignant and powerful memoirs. And in fact, I think met Clint Hill back in 2009. Mr. Hill never really spoke about his service until Lisa McCubbin said, "Hey, let's talk about this." And three books later, here we are. So it is my humble, distinct honor to present to our audience, and we've got listeners all the way from Germany listening live. I want to say hello to you. Germany, France, I can't count the countries all the way into the United States listening right now. I want to welcome everyone, but this in particular, welcome Lisa McCubbin and Clint Hill. How are you both?
Fine. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
We're doing fine. Well, I'm going to start out with a question, if I may. where to start? But by the way, folks, Clint Hill's website, ClintHillSecretService.com, and Lisa, her website is LisaMcCubbin.com. In the show description, we have the links to their various websites. They're also on Facebook and Twitter. But let me just ask this. And we can start wherever you want, but I'm just kind of curious, how did you get Clint Hill, who I saw that day in 1975, so racked with emotion, unable to really talk about what happened to Dallas, how did you get him to open up about his life of service under five administrations?
Well, it happened over a period of several months. I first met him in August of 2009. I was actually writing a book with another former agent named Gerald Blaine, who was a longtime family friend of mine, and we collaborated on a book called The Kennedy Detail. And Jerry Blaine had been one of the agents on Kennedy's Secret Service detail, but he had been on the midnight shift during the assassination, so he wasn't present during the assassination. And as we were writing the book, I said to him, you know, as a writer, I feel like I need to talk to somebody who was there. And he said, well, really, the only person you should talk to is Clint Hill, but he doesn't talk to anybody. And Jerry had been friends with him for a long time, but he knew that Clint had really kind of dropped out of society and hadn't really kept up with his friends. But he contacted him and mentioned the book, and at first Clint didn't want to have anything to do with it at all. But Jerry convinced him that I was trustworthy, that he'd known me for a long time. And so Clint agreed to meet with me in Washington, D.C. for 2 hours at the Hay Adams Hotel. And at that time, he was a completely different man than he is today, I will say. He gave me 2 hours, didn't really share too much with me other than what I could have learned on the Internet. But I did see that there was still a lot of emotion that was buried there. And the astonishing thing that he told me that day was that he had never talked about the assassination with anyone other than that interview with Mike Wallace in 1975, and now this was 2009. So, he really was struggling with it still. So he made one mistake that day, though. At the end of the interview, you know, I'm a reporter by nature, and I said, I may have some follow-up questions as I'm writing the book. Could I have your phone number in case I need to call you? Well, that was his mistake. He gave me his phone number. And so I called him, and I called him, and I called him. And little by little, he would tell me more. And I could see as our conversations went on that burden lifting off of his shoulders. And after several months, I think he really grew to trust me. And he finally called me one day and said, all right, I'll just tell you the whole damn story. And he went on for about 2 hours, and I was scribbling furiously. But that's how it all began.
Oh, man. Well, that's a great story. And, folks, I would urge everyone, if you're like me and you like history, the three books that Lisa McCubbin and Mr. Clint Hill had co-authored, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, 5 days in November, and then, of course, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, and Ford. What tremendous reads. And just think about this, folks. Mr. Hill is such an iconic, the history that he has witnessed, the history that America has witnessed, even through his eyes in these books, and as Ms. McCubbin has really assisted in laying out, it's just fantastic. So it's rich in history. So let me go back, and you've given so many talks, Lisa and Mr. Hill. You began your Secret Service. You started in the Secret Service under Eisenhower, and is that true? And then Eisenhower was your first presidential detail?
Yes, that's correct. I started out in 1958.
Okay.
I had been a special agent in counterintelligence for the government, working with the Department of the Army. And then when it was time to get out, I decided I wanted to do something similar. Secret Service was very small, and so I chose that agency to apply to. I didn't get in right away because there were just no vacancies, but finally a guy retired, and I got his spot. And that was during the Eisenhower administration, and within a year, I was permanently assigned to the White House, assigned to protect President Eisenhower.
And there, apparently you spent a lot of time on the golf course, as I understand it, but the transition between Eisenhower and then Kennedy, that had to be a real kind of a whiplash, to use a term that we use here often, kind of a whole different playing field.
Well, it is. All transitions are very difficult to work with and handle. I mean, it's such a change from one to the next. But that one was quite difficult. Eisenhower was 7 years old. He was a grandfather. Kennedy was 43. His wife, they had had a young daughter born in 1957. And now she was just 3 years old. And his wife, who was only 31, was pregnant. And so we had a completely different situation on our hands when we began protecting the President, Mrs. Kennedy.
Right, right. And you know, when I heard your other interviews and, of course, your books, I found it fascinating that when you were called and they assigned you not to Jack Kennedy, President Kennedy, but to Mrs. Kennedy, you kind of, you weren't too pleased with that.
I was very upset. I was rather angry, disgusted, disappointed, because I knew that all the action always was with wherever the President was or whoever it was.
Right.
I was going to be saddled with the protection of the First Lady. Well, in the past, I had agent friends who had worked with Bess Truman, had worked with Mamie Eisenhower. They watched fashion shows, tea parties, and canasta games. And that wasn't what I really had in mind. I wanted to be where there was the real action, and now I was going to be saddled with that particular job. And I had to accept that there was no choice, but it was reluctantly that I went over to meet Mrs. Kennedy just 2 days after the election of 1960.
But it turned out to be the best assignment in the Secret Service.
Without doubt, it did turn out to be the very best assignment.
Well, tell us a little bit more, because to me this is fascinating. The Kennedys, I suspect, had a really tight family time. And you get into detail in your books, and I would urge everyone to go to Mr. Hill's website, ClintHillSecretService.com, Lisa McCubbin's website, LisaMcCubbin.com. Follow him on Twitter and Facebook as well. Twitter, that is, at Clint Hill _ Secret Service, and at Lisa _ McCubbin, and Facebook as well, by the way. But having said that, but definitely grab a hold of their books for a rich period of history, but describe, if you don't mind, the family oriented life of the Kennedys and your position in that.
Well, we were thrust into a situation where the Kennedys had a regular schedule. They would spend almost all summer, starting usually late May and into September up at Cape Cod, and then in September they'd get out, the President and Mrs. Kennedy would get out to Newport to spend time with her mother and stepfather. And then they'd come back to Hinesport for Thanksgiving. And then Christmas, New Year's, and Easter, they'd go down to Palm Beach. But up in Hinesport, the entire Kennedy family would be together. That meant Ambassador Joe Kennedy and his wife Rose, Robert Kennedy, his wife Ethel, and all of their kids, Eunice Kennedy Shriver and her husband Sergeant Shriver and their children, Jean Smith and her husband Steve and their family, Teddy Kennedy was there, he had a place near the Kennedy compound, and so that entire group was together constantly, and we had to sort out things as to what our responsibility was, who we were protecting, and we had some difficulty because we would set a car out for use by the President. It was a Lincoln convertible, and we didn't have any problem in the past. We'd just leave the keys in it because it was inside a secure perimeter. But with Kennedy's, for example, Eunice, she'd get in the car and just drive off like it was her own car. But it was our car that we were going to use for the President. And so we had different kind of problems like that. We spent a lot of time on the water because every day they would go out on the water around 10 o'clock in the morning. And they would spend most of the day out there, lunch out there, and everything. That meant Mrs. Kennedy would water ski, the President would swim, he loved to sail, there'd be a sailboat out there, and the press were there in numbers and boats trying to get whatever information they could, number of pictures. We had to try and keep them away, at least give the President, Mrs. Kennedy, and the rest of the family significant room in North Carolina to have some kind of a life. And so it was quite a challenge.
Wow, I can imagine. I love some of the stories you recount, both in your book, but also in interviews about the different things that happened in the daily life of a president, and how from Eisenhower to Ford, how many different things, how things changed and everything. My goodness. As we go through the administrations, and again, I would recommend everyone grab a hold of all three of their books, including The Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. But with the Kennedys, such a transition from Eisenhower, as you mentioned, grandfather, didn't really like to press the flesh, versus Kennedy liked to get out and press the flesh. And of course, that had to create like a nightmare for you, you and your agents. Wow.
That was difficult because, as you say, President Eisenhower was not a political man. He came into the presidency, he was sought by both parties, decided to run as a Republican, but he didn't like to go out and press the flesh, get among the crowds, whereas Kennedy, if he saw a crowd of two, he was going over to shake hands.
Yeah, and that kind of, because I'd like to move this really to cover the entire spectrum of your career. I'm not even sure, Mr. Hill, or is anyone besides you, has anyone besides you covered that span of presidents? I don't think.
Oh yes, sir. My first boss at the White House, Jim Rowley, he covered more presidents than I did. He was there with Roosevelt and Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy.
Oh wow.
Johnson.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Into the Nixon administration.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's interesting. All right. Well, as we go through, tell me this. What was one of your fondest memories? And I've gotten, ever since we put out that you were going to be on tonight's show, I've gotten so many emails from people. In fact, one person in France, thank you so much, Constance in France, wanted me to ask you this question. And I guess this would be the proper time to do it. What's your favorite memory from Jacqueline Kennedy and or Jack Kennedy? What's your favorite memory at that time? The happy memory, the good stuff, when you were on their details.
The happiest times that we had were when President Mrs. Kennedy and the children were all together, and usually up at the Cape or down in Palm Beach, and they had the opportunity to really just be a family. That specifically would happen when we were out in the water, for example. Caroline loved to swim. She was very good at it. She would dive off the presidential yacht into her father's arms who was out in the water swimming. Mrs. Kennedy was a great swimmer herself. She loved to water ski. She'd be out there when we went to Europe in 1962. She brought Caroline along and she began to teach her how to water ski. And she got in a lot of trouble for the press for that because they had no safety equipment. And she had Caroline up on the skis with her. And I know in the London press really told her, don't do that, Mrs. Kennedy. Please don't take the risk of injuring Caroline. And so it got to be kind of a problem. But the best times were when they were all together as a family, when they were so happy when they were in that situation.
Understood.
And that's one of the reasons Clint actually agreed to write our first book, Mrs. Kennedy and Me, is he said there had been so much written about her that just wasn't true, written by friends of friends or people that, you know, didn't really know her. And what he saw was this family that really cared about each other, and he wanted to write that down for history and let people know that Jack Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy really did adore each other, despite, you know, all the rumors that persist.
Wow. Okay. And Lisa, I'm going to defer to you to some of these questions because, you know, folks, we're talking to a historic legend in Mr. Hill. Of course, memories seared into my memory, of course, is the horrible day in 1963 where the gentleman climbing on the back of the limousine, that's who we're talking to, okay? That is who we're talking to. And that's how many people will remember him. But his career, his experience is so much more than that. The rich history, so much more. And Lisa McCubbin has brought this out, and together they've really written some fantastic, three fantastic books about this era and expanding on this. So, Lisa, I'm going to defer to you in some questions as it, because you've done great jobs with this, with answering questions and kind of directing the narrative through the history of Clint Hill. I'm going to turn it over to you to pick up, especially that time period in Dallas. I want to be very respectful of this. This is not a who shot who show type thing. This is about what Mr. Hill felt, and I feel you could draw him out a lot more, or draw the emotion out a lot better than we can. So,
sure. Well, let me just say, when I first met him, as I said, he couldn't talk about it and didn't want to talk about it, but then he started to, and when we would go out in public and he would tell the story, it was very difficult at first. It was very painful, and it still is. You know, you can still feel the emotion from him, but he said that it does get easier and better for him to address it and to talk about it. So, Clint, why don't you just tell us first of all, why did that trip to Texas occur?
Well, it was decided in the spring of 1963. President Kennedy met with Vice President Johnson and Governor Connally down in El Paso, Texas. They had a meeting, and they decided that in order to win the election of 1964, they were going to have to take two of the large states in the South to get significant electoral votes to win the election. And so they selected Florida and Texas. And so the weekend of November 16, 17, and 18, President Kennedy went into Florida. He went to Palm Beach, Cape Canaveral, Tampa, and then Miami. In Tampa, they had a 26-mile motorcade, and the advance agent was Gerald Wayne, and he had asked the agents assigned them to ride up in the back of the presidential vehicle during the entire motorcade because it was warm and humid that day, and he knew that they'd never last 26 miles running on the ground. And so he assigned them up there in a permanent position. About halfway through, President Kennedy turned around. He noticed that these two agents were there. The crowd had dropped off a little bit, and he reached forward. He tapped the agent in the right front seat on the shoulder and said, Floyd, he said, will you get those Ivy League charlatans off the back of the car, please? Now, we didn't have any idea what he meant by Ivy League charlatans, but we knew what he meant, get off the back of the car. So they did eventually get off the back of the car when they were able to do so. When the motorcade finished, he came to the advance agent and the supervisor and said, look, if the agents are up in the back of the car like that, it's going to appear to the general public that there's something between them and myself. I cannot afford that to happen. If that is going to be the case, I couldn't get elected Dulcich. Said, so from now on, unless it's an absolute emergency, don't have agents posted up on the back of the car. Now, nothing was written about it. It was just words passed down that that's the situation that would continue from that point on.
And that was just several days before he flew to Denver.
That was on Monday, November 18th, 1963. And so then on November 21st, we left Washington to go to Texas. It was going to be a three-day trip, the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. We were going to go to San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas, Austin, and the LBJ Ranch. And then we were going to fly back to Washington in time for John Jr.'s third birthday on the 25th of November.
And why were you there, Clint?
I was there because Mrs. Kennedy was going to make this trip. She came to me and told me she wanted to make this trip, that she, in 1960, was unable to contribute significantly to the president's candidacy because she was pregnant with John. But this time, she was going to do everything she could to help him get reelected. And so she was going to start by going on this trip to Texas. And that's the reason I was on the trip, was because of Mrs. Kennedy. She was my responsibility.
And so what was the reception like when you first got to your first stop there in San Antonio?
We had an amazingly large number of people show up. Crowds were very, very large. They were very enthusiastic and exuberant, and they were very, very friendly. And this was the same situation all the way through San Antonio, on over into Houston, same situation. And then finishing in Houston, we went on Air Force One and flew over to Carswell Air Force Base near Fort Worth, and went into Fort Worth, got in there at 11:05 at night, was raining. The crowds at Carswell were large. Whole families were there with their children. And I thought, boy, why are these people out here with their children in the rain at 11 o'clock at night? It seemed rather strange. And then I thought, you're getting kind of jaded, Clay Hill. You've been around the president too long. You don't remember that this is probably the only opportunity that family's ever going to have to see a president up close and personal. And so it was understandable. But as we went into the city and approached the Texas Hotel, there were thousands of people outside the hotel. We had a difficult time getting into the hotel itself. There are photographs that will show you that. Mm-hmm.
And so you ended up in Fort Worth late at night, and then the next morning you were going to fly from Fort Worth to Dallas in Lovefield, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
You could not have driven there.
Fly. Exactly.
We could have. We could have driven there faster. We would have gone to the Trademark in Dallas, and we were leaving the Hotel Texas in Fort Worth. It would have taken us less time to drive directly to the Trademark. We had to drive from the hotel to Carswell, get an Air Force One, taxi, take off, fly, approach, land, get off the aircraft at Lovefield, then get in cars and go through the entire city of Dallas to get to our destination. The reason that it was done that way was not because we wanted it. It was because the politicians wanted a photograph of President and Mrs. Kennedy coming off the rear of Air Force One in Dallas. And that's what they got. And so, it was rather strange. We had been in Fort Worth. We take off. We land in Dallas. President and Mrs. Kennedy come off, go through the usual receiving line. And at the first people in the receiving line were Vice President and Mrs. Johnson. Well, they had just saying goodbye to them 10 minutes before over in Fort Worth. So, I mean, it's obvious that it wasn't, it was strictly
a political setup.
Right. All for the photo op, right?
That's right.
All it was a photo opportunity.
And so you had a great reception at Love Field, and then you get in the cars and head into downtown Dallas.
The reception at Love Field was large. The president saw the numbers of people there. He immediately went over to them, started shaking hands. Mrs. Kennedy normally doesn't do that, but she did in this case. We finally got him into the cars, and we had flown our cars in special cars for this motorcade. It was Secret Service car 100X. It was an open-aired stretch Lincoln. It had a capability of having a bubble on it, but that was only to be used. These were President Kennedy's directions. That bubble was only to be used in the event of adverse weather, such as rain or snow, or if it was so windy, it would affect Mrs. Kennedy's hair. Other than that, the bubble was to be off, and the bubble was off. So it had been raining in Dallas, but as soon as it was determined that that was stopping, they took the bubble off, and that was standard procedure. It wasn't anything special new for Dallas. So we got him in the car. We started into downtown Dallas. We had to get down to Main Street, where the majority of people were, because they wanted this maximum exposure motorcade. The purpose of the trip was to get as many people to see President and Mrs. Kennedy as possible. And so we got down to Main Street, and the crowds were real heavy, 10, 15, 20 deep on each side of the street. The driver of the presidential vehicle was keeping the car farther to the left as you drove down the street to keep the president. He was in the right rear, away from the crowd. That put Mrs. Kennedy right up next to the crowd on the left-hand side. I would get off my position, which was on the running board of the car immediately behind the president. It's called the follow-up car. I would run up, get on the back of the car, and be as close to Mrs. Kennedy as I could to prevent anything from happening to her. And I did this 4 or 5 times as we traveled down Main Street. Now, I knew the president didn't want us up there, but I also knew what my responsibility was, and I also knew that if he asked anything or said anything, I'd be able to explain it to him. I had no fear of that whatsoever. So then we got down to Houston Street toward the end of Main. Had to turn right because we had to get on the Stemmons Freeway to get us out to the Trademark. And we took one block on Houston and then had to go left on Elm Street. And that put us right in front of a building called the Texas School Book Depository. Now, the crowds had really dropped off. There weren't many people in that area compared to how many there had been along Main Street. We had been, as agents on the follow-up car, we had been surveying the buildings as we traveled down the street. Most of the buildings had windows open. There were people hanging out of windows. There were people on fire escapes, on balconies, wherever they could be to get a better visual of President Mrs. Kennedy. There were 2 or 3 windows open on the Texas School Book Depository, but we saw nothing that looked dangerous or a problem for us. And we approached that. We had to make a very sharp left-hand turn onto Elm Street. The cars, we had to slow way down. We've been running 10 to 12 miles per hour. Now we had to go very, very slow to make this turn. And as we started to straighten out on Elm, which was going down toward a triple underpass underneath the railroad line, and so the roadway was kind of slanted. We were about 150 feet from the entrance from Houston. I was scanning the area to my left and straight ahead at that overpass, and all of a sudden I heard an explosive noise over my right shoulder. It came from the rear. I started to turn toward that noise, as did all the other agents. But I only got as far as the back of the president's car, because I saw what happened. I saw the president grab at his throat and start to fall to his left. I then realized this was a gunshot. At first, when I first heard the noise, I didn't think it sounded like a gunshot. But that was probably because there was an echo in that area because of the buildings and the underpass. And so I then jumped from my position and started to run toward the presidential vehicle with the intent of getting up on the top of the back of it to form a shield there to prevent anything further from happening to either President or Mrs. Kennedy. As I jumped off the follow-up car, there was a motorcycle officer immediately to my left. I had to get between him and the follow-up car, which meant there was a lot of noise in that area. So later the agents told me there had been a second shot at that time. I didn't even hear it because of the noise of the engines. Then as I approached the presidential vehicle, I was just about there, and there was another shot that rang out. This one I not only heard, I felt it, because it hit the president in the head. At that time, he had fallen farther to his left. His head was down, slanted somewhat, down in a downward position. And the bullet entered in the rear of the head, kind of low in the rear, and then exited just above the right ear and blew a portion of the skull there forward, still attached to the scalp, but material erupted out of that wound, blood, brain matter, bone fragments. And they got all over me, all over Mrs. Kennedy, all over the back of the car. When that happened, I was able to get a hold of the handhold on the car and get myself started to get up on the trunk. And just as I did that, she came out of the seat and climbed up on the back of the trunk from the seat position. She was trying to reach some of the material that had come out of the president's head. She didn't even know I was there. So I got a hold of her and I put her in the back seat. When I did that, the president's body fell to its left with his head ending up in her lap. The right side of his face was up. I could see that his eyes were fixed. I could see there was a hole in the skull and there was just no brain matter in that general area of the skull at all. So I immediately assumed it was a fatal wound. I turned and I gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew to make sure all the other agents knew how serious this was. And then I turned and screamed at the driver to get us to the nearest hospital. And he accelerated. The chief of police from Dallas, Curry, got in front of us in his car and led us to Parkland Hospital. I was wedged up on the top of the back seat. We were traveling upwards towards 80 miles an hour as we traveled down the Stevens Freeway to what turned out to be a Parkland Hospital.
Wow. Wow. You know, I've heard, and Joe, we've all heard your discussions, your previous interviews, but again, going back to 1975, I think it was 4 months after you left the Secret Service, 12 years after that day in 1963, you carried around a lot of guilt, a lot of internalized guilt that you could have done something differently that day. Personally, I think, well, who cares what I think except to say I think that your actions were not only heroic but nearly superhuman as you watch the Zapruder film and you watch you see your actions, but that had to be just so remarkably tough for you that day. My goodness,
it ate at me over time too as well, and I did have that very serious sense of guilt that we hadn't done the job we were charged to do. We failed in our mission. And so it became more difficult as time went on because it just ate at me.
Sure. Well, you know, and I understand that. And I heard the question asked before, and I certainly am no expert in this, but, you know, I heard the question asked, you know, could anything have been done different? Well, I'll ask you. I mean, the rumors about the agent's behavior before, or, you know, the night before.
Yeah, there's a lot of the night before, and then I believe when you described making that slow turn onto Elm, there has always been speculation on why the Secret Service seemed to fall back or jump off the back car.
Yeah, I mean, it's any thoughts on that, or was that just the way it was that back then?
Well, as we turned off of Houston on Elm, we were on the sideboards of the follow-up car, not on the presidential vehicle. But that was because of the president's directive that we not be on the vehicle.
The
crowds had dropped off, yeah. So more than likely we would not have been on the back of the president's car at that time anyway, because the crowds had really dissipated compared to what they had been previously.
Okay.
Now, I can say for sure that there only were three shots that they fired in Dealey Plaza. They all came from the same position, the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. There are all kinds of conspiracy theories out there about Degrassi Knoll, about all other kinds of situations. But really, the truth is that they were only those three shots. They all came from that Mannlicher Carcano rifle that Lee Harvey Oswald had ordered over him from a Chicago mailhouse and practiced with when he got it and used it and fatally killed President Kennedy.
You know, I heard I heard a question asked of you. I think it was at a symposium in Dallas. I think it was a year or two ago. When will the real story come out? And your response was, it's already out. So
it's it. The story has already been told. Okay. Many people will never believe that there was one individual who could do this acting alone. But the truth of the matter is, just go into research assassinations or attempted assassinations, you'll find out that 90% of the time or 99% of the time, it's one individual acting out for the first time, unknown prior to that to the local authorities, and, you know, it just happened that this was that kind of a case. If you take look at the case of the congresswoman from Arizona that down in Arizona, she got shot.
Gabby Giffords.
Same situation. This guy just all of a sudden acted out. Nobody knew anything. He had a grievance or anything like that. Ronald Reagan gets shot by Hinckley. Same situation. We had no idea that Hinckley had a thing for Reagan. Same thing with George Wallace when he got shot in Maryland when he was running in 1972. So, I mean, it just goes back in history. And it, one of those situations, very hard for people to really look at and say, gee, maybe that is the case, because I just can't believe one person could do that.
It's amazing to some, and look, there are so many theories out there. We get all that. And folks, this interview is not about any conspiracy about what happened. This interview really is to really take a look at Clint Hill, at his rich life under five administrations, mm-hmm. the challenges of the Secret Service to the Secret Service. But really, this very rich period of history that we are so blessed to have, Mr. Hill and Lisa McCubbin here discuss this with us. But
we got about 18 minutes left in the
interview. Yeah,
if we can move on, something that I find interesting, and you obviously have firsthand knowledge of this, the Johnson presidency after the assassination of Kennedy. That obviously had to be much different from any other transition of power from president to president. Can you tell us how it was different and what the attitudes were like of Johnson and the people who were a part of that administration?
Well, it happened so instantaneously. That's the big difference. It was nothing that you could plan for leading up to it. It happened on that 22nd November 1963. There were two camps, the Kennedy camp and the Johnson camp. There's no question about that. They had different ideologies somewhat, and I wasn't there during 1964. I remained with Mrs. Kennedy and the children for a year after the assassination. Went up to New York and lived there, and then came back to the Johnson administration right after the presidential election in 1974, in November 1964. That was a different transition for me, going from Mrs. Kennedy then now to Lyndon Johnson and the Johnson administration. At first he didn't even want me there because he thought I couldn't be loyal to him because I'd been with the Kennedys. He was convinced by one of my supervisors that it was in his best interest to have me there, and so he agreed that they'd give it a shot try, and then a couple years later they made me the agent in charge of his protection. And then a few years later, 1968 and 69, when he was leaving office, he tried to get me to move with him down to Johnson City, Texas, to spend the rest of my career in the Secret Service protecting him at the LBJ Ranch, but I managed to convince him that I didn't take my career path, went along the banks of the Ferdinand River, and he agreed to that finally. But there was a difference in the Johnson administration from the Kennedy administration, no question. That Johnson was able to enact more legislation probably than any previous president in the time that he was in office. He loved his LBJ Ranch and spent as much time down there as he could. He would bring heads of state, heads of government down there. He'd bring the cabinet down there. Bring the Joint Chiefs of Staff down there. They would meet out in the lawn of the ranch house there at the LBJ Ranch and decide the budget for the following year, whatever year it was going to be, or discuss how to go about continuing the fight in Vietnam. I mean, it was spend more time down at the LBJ Ranch than we probably did at the White House at times.
Well, and the Vietnam War, this was something that I found really fascinating as we were writing this book, was what Clint witnessed with LBJ. You know, I had kind of grown up hearing that Vietnam was LBJ's war, and it was his fault in a way, and that's why we were in Vietnam. But really, as you read our book, you see it kind of follows the transition of the president, as well as the flow of the Vietnam War, which actually started with Eisenhower and then ended with Ford. And with LBJ, Clint, you really saw how he struggled with all of that.
He had a very difficult time. It was very emotional.
You could hear the protests. And I mean, I remember this as a young man hearing, having the protests in the streets about the Vietnam War, the anti-war protests, and apparently you could hear that inside the White House, correct?
Well, you could hear them out in the street. They were on Pennsylvania Avenue and on Lafayette Park, and they were screaming, hey, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? So we heard that, and he heard it. And what really affected him more than anything else was every night he would walk from his bedroom down the hallway in the second floor of the White House and pick up a phone, like down the Lincoln bedroom, and call the Situation Room and ask for the body count. They would tell him how many had been killed and how many had been wounded. And then he'd go back to his bedroom, or sometimes he would call and ask for a car, and he'd go down to the Catholic Church just off Main Avenue in Washington, D.C., and go in, and he'd sit down and talk to some of the priests that were there, knowing that they'd never say anything. But it was really affecting him emotionally. Mm. And so then in 1968, it wasn't really that surprising, although I was somewhat shocked when he announced that he wouldn't accept the nomination for the presidency from his own party, knowing that he had been the majority leader of the Senate, he'd now been vice president for years, and now president. And to give all that up, I thought that was remarkable. I was very surprised that he really actually decided to give it up.
Yeah, he was indeed a politician's politician.
No question about that. He was a 100% politician. He knew how to get things done.
Right.
He could harangue people into doing things you just wouldn't believe. I mean, Dick Russell was a very good friend of him and his, and he wanted Dick Russell to be on the Warren Commission. And Russell didn't want to be on the Warren Commission because he didn't like Chief Justice Warren. So one day Johnson called him over to the office and he confronted him about this, and he said, Dick, he said, geez, he said, the press already has been told that you've accepted this. I don't know how we're going to explain to him that you are unwilling to serve on the commission. I mean, he set him up to force him to take the position on the Warren Commission. And it was a great position to have because he was a great man, Senator Russell.
Interesting. You know, Mr. Hill, if I can ask this question, we are living in some really tumultuous times today. You see the, you saw yesterday with the UC Berkeley, the protests, the well, not protests, but the riots. And then you over the last, I don't know, well, ever since the election, you're seeing this, this upset, this unrest all across the United States. Does this parallel what you witnessed back in the late 60s? How would you compare today versus back then in terms of society and what's taking place?
Well, in the late 60s, things got pretty bad. I mean, the Democratic Convention is a testament to that, where the police had a horrible time there in Chicago. But today, I think the populace in the United States is more divided. At that time, the division was strictly about the Vietnam War in 1968. And now it's...
And race.
Yeah, race was a problem too, but integration. But that, the war was really the leading problem. We had large, massive demonstrations, more than 100,000 at a time in Washington, D.C. But now the country is divided again. But now it's not about that. It's about the president being elected. And so it's difficult. It's very challenging for the Secret Service, I can say that. So they have a greater challenge today than they've ever had, in my opinion. Much more so than we had back in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. They're meeting that challenge, doing a good job, in my opinion, from what I've seen.
Sure.
But it's going to be a difficult next few years, I think.
Wow. I respect you. I got to tell you, I respect you and every Secret Service agent on that detail who says, "Yeah, I'm going to lay, I'll be your bullet shield or your, you know." Yeah. Really? Wow.
Talk about job commitment.
Yeah.
Clint, if we can, obviously the Kennedy assassination and that transition had to be the worst. But what was the most difficult? Who was your favorite president to work with, and who was the most difficult president you had to work with?
I really don't have a favorite president, but they're all so different. The only thing they really had in common was an ego, some larger than others, and some were more difficult to work with than others because, I mean, they had their certain things about them. Like Johnson, for example, thought that if he didn't tell anybody what he was doing, what he was going to do anything, then nobody could do his harm because nobody would know what was going on. Well, that included us sometimes. He wouldn't even tell us what he wanted to do. All of a sudden, he'd just say, "This is what I'm doing," or he'd come out of the ranch house, get in a golf cart and start driving out to the helipad where there was also a Jetstar. Now, we didn't know if he was going to take that Jetstar and fly to Detroit or Houston, or if he was going to get an helicopter and go into Austin, or going to take a car and go over and see a neighbor's ranch. Until he made the decision when he got out of the golf cart to get in the particular conveyance he was going to use. Then he'd tell us what he was going to do. So it was troubling. That was one of the challenges we had there. We went around the world once with little knowledge of where our next stop was going to be. That was 1967. That was with Johnson. And then you come into
Mr. Hill, wait a second. Is that where? And folks, you got to read his books. Clint Hill is our guest along with Lisa McCubbin, but his books, of course, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. But was that where President Johnson was on the top of the plane and you were at the bottom?
Yes.
Yeah.
can you tell that story real quick?
Well, we had gone to Australia to attend a funeral for Prime Minister Holt to a drop. But when we got to Australia, he decided to keep on going around the world. And we went from Australia to Thailand to Vietnam to Pakistan to Rome, Italy. Finally, we get to Rome and he sees President of Italy and the Pope. And we get him on the airplane. This is the middle of the night. It's Christmas Eve, 1967. He puts on his pajamas and he goes to bed on board the aircraft. There's a presidential suite on there. So he can now, we're going to take off and fly toward Washington. We have to land in the Azores to refuel. So the pilot decides that since we're going to refuel there, I'll call ahead and have the postage change stay open so everybody on the plane can get off and buy some Christmas gifts for their families, because it's Christmas Eve. We haven't had a chance to do anything like that. So Johnson's asleep. We land. Everybody comes off the plane. They get on a bus to go over to the PX. I told them all to go. I'd stay there with Johnson because he was sleeping. They're all gone, and I'm down at the foot of the ramp, and all of a sudden I hear this, "Hey, Clint, where is everybody?" And it's Johnson. He's up on top of the ramp, standing in his pajamas. I said, "Mr. President," I said, "they've all gone to the post exchange because it is Christmas Eve, and they want to buy some gifts if they can buy some." He says, "Well, hell, I haven't had a chance to buy anything either, so let's go." So now he's in his pajamas. He reaches in a closet and grabs a trench coat, puts it on. Down the ramp he comes. I put him in an Air Force car that happened to be there, told the driver to take us over to the post exchange. Get out of the car, walk into the post exchange, and the employees and everybody in there just froze. They couldn't believe. Here's a commander-in-chief of the United States Armed Forces, the leader of the free world, walking around in his pajamas in the middle of the night, buying Christmas gifts. I mean, this was a photo op that the press missed, because they had flown on to Shannon, Ireland to refuel.
You can't make that up. I mean, that's just, to me, that I heard that, and that is just fantastic. My goodness. We only have a few minutes left, and one question here from a listener is for Lisa. Lisa, Karen from Iowa wants to know about your fondest memory. Your fondest memory in writing in co-authoring the three books. What was your fondest memory or your aha moment with respect to any one of the three books you wrote with Clint Hill? What was that one time when you thought, man, this is like great stuff?
I don't know. It's almost on a daily basis. But that story that he just told, when he told me that, that was before we had even talked about writing Five Presidents. And that story alone, I said, is worth building a book around, because it really does give you such an insight. I've spent so much time with Clint, and it's truly a pleasure. And I know many people envy me. But, we'll be watching the news together or something, and he just knows so much about everything. And there's so many moments when he'll say, "Oh yeah, I was there. You know, that was, you know, Queen somebody's funeral." And, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral. "Oh yeah, I was there." You know, he was just, it's like Forrest Gump. There were just so many times he was at these moments in history that really staggering, and to have him be able to share those stories with all of us. I guess thinking of one moment, the moment that he agreed to write Mrs. Kennedy and me, he had said, no, I'm never going to write a book ever. And, I could tell the admiration he had for her just in being with him. And I said, "You know, Clint, you can write this book and have it be a tribute to Mrs. Kennedy. And you can put in what you want to put in and leave out what you want to leave out. It's your book." And when he thought about it like that, he said, okay, I'll do it. I want to write a tribute to Mrs. Kennedy. And that's how Mrs. Kennedy and Me came about. And I think it really is a lovely tribute to a wonderful First Lady.
That's magnificent. And I do have a copy of Mrs. Kennedy and Me. Just, and folks, it's a wonderful book. It really is. It's, and that's why, I mean, I told Ms. McCubbin and Mr. Hill before we began this interview, I said, you know, I'm nervous. I mean, it's like, this icon of history. Yeah, but, and both Lisa McCubbin.
And he's so humble. I mean, I was like that too when I first met him, but, you know, when you get to know him, he's just, he's the most humble guy, and he has a great sense of humor. I think most people wouldn't expect that, but he really does have a great sense of humor.
Well, you know what? I just want to thank both of you. We're at the end of the hour, and I just want to thank both of you for your time, your gracious gift of time. I do hope people will purchase all of your books, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, and of course, Mrs. Kennedy and Me. I can recommend all of them, but that one too, in 5 days in November. And Ms. McCubbin, your books as well, and follow them on the social networking sites. God bless you both. And Mr. Hill, God bless you, sir, for your service to your country. You've really, wow. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Folks, what a treat that was. Joe?
Absolutely. Thank you, Clint, and thank you, Lisa, for your time tonight. That was fascinating to just sit back and listen. Hope we can do it again sometime in the future.
And this was about history. You know, this was about the time this wasn't about Grassy Knoll stuff. This was about history.
Mm-hmm. From somebody who was there.
Yeah, yeah. And think about that. Think about that span. Wow. And thank you, Bill McIntosh, Casa Media. Casa Media and John Robertson. God bless you both. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate investigate a maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.